Local faith leaders talk criminal justice reform in Jacksonville and push for change. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, two pastors, part of the upcoming iCare Nehemiah Assembly, talk about their efforts to address issues in the criminal justice system. Give us a call right now. Join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, new ways of understanding addiction. We'll speak with neuroscientist and author Maya Salovitz about her groundbreaking book, The Unbroken Brain. Plus, a little jazz and some heritage in Jacksonville. We'll tell you about the upcoming La Villa Jazz Fest and have a little live music for you, too. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, this hour, they are a diverse coalition of faith leaders. They come from different traditions, but they are united in pressing city and state officials to reform longstanding issues in the criminal justice system. iCare, or the Interfaith Coalition for Action, Reconciliation, and Empowerment, is getting ready for its annual Nehemiah Assembly in Jacksonville. As many as 2,000 people are expected to show up next week for this, along with Sheriff Mike Williams and State Attorney Melissa Nelson. On the agenda, everything from a transparency website for law enforcement to a call from the group to stop issuing citations for fines like jaywalking. That's been controversial. And a whole lot more. Here with a preview and their thoughts about criminal justice reform, we welcome two pastors affiliated with iCare. Pastor Bruce Havens of Arlington United Church of Christ, good morning.
Good morning.
And Pastor Tan Moss of Greater Grant Memorial AME Church, good morning.
Good morning.
Here's our question to callers. When it comes to the criminal justice system and a nationwide push for criminal justice reform, what are your thoughts and comments for the faith leaders of iCare here in Jacksonville? Get on the line now as we talk about their upcoming Nehemiah Assembly, a powerful annual event. The number to join the show, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We welcome your comments as well on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Pastor Tan Moss, let's begin with you. This assembly is coming up next Monday night. You're expecting up to 2,000 people, faith groups, and leaders from all over the city will come together to talk criminal justice issues with Sheriff Williams and State Attorney Nelson. This has really become a powerful force for social change in this city. Can you give us a preview? What's on the agenda for this upcoming Nehemiah Assembly?
Well, we'll talk a little bit more in depth, but three of the main things that we're going to be talking about is increasing the funding for the Jacksonville Reentry Center, and Brother Havens will give a little bit more information about that. We also want to talk about building trust between the sheriff's office and the state attorney's office with the community by creating a user-friendly website that provides crime data to the people in the city. We found that cities like Indianapolis have reduced their public records requests and created trust between the police and the community by having transparency in police stops, complaints, and people who are injured while they're in custody. We're also looking at asking the sheriff or pressing the sheriff to stop providing fines for people who are jaywalking because we found that people who get fines for jaywalking many times are burdened by the financial burden of the $62, as well as many times they lose their license and other things that happen when they suffer these type of fines. So those are the three main issues that we're going to be working on.
And the recent ProPublica Times Union investigation, Walking While Black, brought that into the spotlight. Pastor Havens, how pedestrian traffic citations are disproportionately issued in this city to people of color. That's just one issue that we can talk about with this. Okay, so how, in your view, then, would a website that law enforcement would publish increase transparency when it comes to how law enforcement does its business? And how do you think that could help build trust? Because as Pastor Moss said, a big issue police and prosecutors might have is that there is a perception, at least among some members of the community, that law enforcement is not their friend and is not there to protect them, but is instead targeting them. And that's certainly, I know, a perception a lot of people of color feel, right or wrong. You want to try to address this.
Right. Our Nehemiah Assembly Monday night at Abyssinia Baptist at 7 o'clock, we want to address that issue because we know that is important. We know that as people are able to access that information, they can more readily understand that issues are not ignored, that if there's misconduct, that it will be addressed, that if there are complaints about calls that have been answered in ways that were not helpful or didn't build that trust, that those things are being addressed through the processes that the state's attorney and the JSO are using.
549-2937. What are your thoughts and comments about ICARE, the Interfaith Coalition for Action, Reconciliation, and Empowerment? Their efforts to move forward with criminal justice reform efforts here in the 904. Give us a call. So, Pastor Moss, you're also pressing the sheriff and State Attorney Nelson and others, I take it, to increase funding for the city's reentry center. That helps people leaving prison basically reenter into society. To bring us up to date on that aspect of this.
Absolutely. In 2016, before 1,500 people, the sheriff committed to use $900,000 that came from a state grant to bring the JREC budget up to $1.5 million. We found that after the fiscal year, he returned $600,000 of that money, of the $900,000, back because it was not used. And we were disappointed by that because the JREC program, for those who are reentering society, those who have served their time, it provides housing, employment, health care, transportation, clothing, and really helps them to come back with everything that they need to be successful in society. So we're pressing him to increase that budget back to $1.5 million. He said that prevention is one of his priorities, and we want him to just act on the words that he said by increasing that budget back to $1.5 million. It saves the city tremendous millions of dollars in housing and reoffending and people going back into the criminal justice system. So it's a win-win for everyone.
Recidivism, the idea that if you come out of incarceration, you can't find housing or employment, you're just going to reoffend.
Exactly.
You want to reduce that.
Exactly.
Okay. So Sheriff Williams and State Attorney Melissa Nelson are attending. In the past, you've pressed Mayor Lenny Curry to attend the Nehemiah Assembly. And I believe he did not come last year. Is that right? Are you asking him to attend this year?
We're not directly addressing him, so he has not been directly invited to attend. Obviously, we know he cares about these issues, and we hope he's attending to those issues, but he has not been directly invited.
So this
he's certainly welcome.
He's certainly welcome. In the past, you'd ask candidates for mayor to attend, and then when they didn't show up, that was seen as a slap in the face. It even affected votes. This broad interfaith coalition has real impact.
Well, the Nehemiah's Assembly is the largest community opportunity to see our city officials and to hold them accountable to do what they've been elected to do. And so Monday night at Abyssinia Baptist at 7 o'clock, we have a chance to affect what the sheriff and the state's attorney make as priorities that really affect those who oftentimes don't have a voice and don't have the power to change things for the better in our community.
You really are taking seriously the idea of putting faith into good works, trying to make this community a better place. In the past, what are some of the priorities you've pressed on that you feel you've made a difference?
Well, one of the best and most recent, obviously, is the restorative justice issue, where the state's attorney and the sheriff agreed, after we pressed them, to make giving civil citations rather than arresting first-time, youthful, nonviolent offenders. And we're already seeing they're almost back up to 90% or up to 90% of civil citations instead of arrests. Again, two things, saving lives from having a criminal record and saving millions of tax dollars in the costs of arresting and then incarcerating these young people and ruining their lives.
State Attorney Melissa Nelson, Pastor Moss, was able to become state attorney. Former State Attorney Angela Corey was not reelected, due in part to a difference of approach and how these issues are approached. Many voters didn't like the extremely punitive approach former state attorney Corey took in terms of taking a really hard line on things like not increasing the use of civil citations for minors. Your organization and others had argued that if you can do more diversionary things, you can keep more kids out of what's known as the school-to-prison pipeline. If a minor makes a mistake and they're not given a prison record or a criminal justice record, well, then you're protecting them from getting into the system and you're preserving their future, essentially, I think is the argument that you made and have been making for some time. Do you feel as though the criminal justice apparatus in this city is reforming? Do you feel as though your efforts are making a difference?
Absolutely. We are just very, very pleased with our current state attorney, as well as the progress that the sheriff has made in adopting this idea of civil citations. We currently have four neighborhood accountability boards that are operating in the city. When young people are given civil citations, it's not a slap on the hand. They're actually held accountable for the offenses that they have committed. And they own up to those things. They come to the neighborhood accountability board where community people talk to these people to create empathy and understanding of the crime they've committed, how the victims have been affected, how the community has been affected. And then they issue sanctions that hold them accountable. We have seen over 90% of the young people that have gone through the neighborhood accountability boards, they have completed the program. They have gone on to college, to military careers, and they have become productive citizens because they were given a second chance. So we know that the program works, and we're just thankful for what the sheriff has done thus far because we've seen civil citations double. And we're working towards getting it up to 90% of those who are eligible to receive civil citations. We're also thankful for a bill that was just recently passed that now mandates that all of the state attorneys throughout the state of Florida create these civil citations programs, not only for youth, but also adult civil citation programs. And those who were eligible that were arrested can have those records expunged. And so mm-hmm. we're just thankful for the change that we've seen in the city of Jacksonville, and we believe that it's going to be adopted across the state.
And we'll go to your calls in a moment. What are your thoughts about the most important issues when it comes to reforming the criminal justice system? Give us a call as we talk about the iCare Nehemiah Assembly. The number to join us, 549-2937. Now, Pastor Bruce Havens, Arlington United Church of Christ, one of the things you're going to press the sheriff on is to stop issuing citations with fines for things like jaywalking, biking on the sidewalk, those minor pedestrian types of infractions that, as Pastor Moss said, you get a $65 ticket for that. This recent investigation, Walking While Black, showed that many of the tickets have been issued in error, that African Americans are issued a disproportionately high number of these citations, and sometimes it can result in the loss of a driver's license, which can lead to the loss of your job. So there are real economic impacts to this. The sheriff has addressed this investigation. He took some issue with the data that ProPublica and the Times Union uncovered, but he did acknowledge that this issue of implicit bias is likely a factor in at least some of these citations. What is your strategy, I guess, in terms of pressing the leadership of JSO on this? It doesn't seem like they would likely call a moratorium on issuing these citations. At least they have not yet. Civil rights groups have pressed for that. But the sheriff's office doesn't seem as though it's going to change its policy on this.
Well, one of the things that's at least pretty clear is that those where there's issues with pedestrians being in danger because they're jaywalking are not where the citations are being issued. They're being issued in places in our neighborhoods where people of color are more predominantly present, whereas the accidents or the injuries are happening in other places. One of the things we want to do to hold accountable and to have a building of that trust with the website will allow some clarity on where some of these geographically happen, what are the demographics of those who are getting these kinds of experiences. And then, we know that the big issue is officer discretion. Well, the important thing is if we want to educate people to prevent these things from happening, we want to encourage that officer discretion to focus on education rather than on being punitive, or is using those for gateways to other charges or inciting something that happens where, you know, there's an encounter that becomes a negative experience for the officer and for the public.
Let's go to some calls now as we talk about the I Care Nehemiah Assembly coming up next Monday night. What are your questions, comments? 549-2937. Give us a call right now. Let's go over to Peggy in Avondale. Hi, Peggy. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm such a fan of I Care. I would like to know, what is the address of the Baptist Church where the Nehemiah Assembly is going to be?
Sure. It's, let's see here. It's the Abyssinia Missionary Baptist Church. It's coming at Monday night, 6:30 p.m., and they are at 10325 Interstate Center Drive. Is that correct, gentlemen?
Yes, it's just off of 95 north towards the airport on the west side of 95.
Peggy, I hope that helps you out. 10325 Interstate Center Drive, Jacksonville.
It will help me, and I will be there. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Great. Thanks for that call. Marcus is downtown. Hi, Marcus. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm a criminal defense attorney with the Barnett Law Firm. There's absolutely an issue here with how the police treat minorities. The real underlying issue is this. They use a zero tolerance model, and it was an old approach that failed in New York City, where they would go after what they called quality of life crimes. They did a lot of stop and frisk associated with it. And what happened is they alienated the very people they are trying to protect. Our ability to solve major crimes depends on people cooperating with the police. People know who shoot guns. People know who the drug dealers are. And if they don't trust the police, they're not going to cooperate. So the sheriff's entire approach to this needs to be developing a sense of community so that the public renews trust in the police and in the criminal justice system. I applaud the efforts of these individuals you have on your show to try to do that. And I wonder if they have a broader strategy to try to build a better sense of cooperation and teamwork where people don't see police as the enemy.
Marcus, thanks so much. I know that's a big part of your focus. Pastor Moss.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Marcus. One of the things that iCare does, we seek to solve problems in the community by pressing our leaders. We have a four-stage process in which we do that. First of all, we listen to the community members, the problems that are going on in the community, and we vote on issues that we're going to address. We then do research to find out what is working in other cities that are the size of Jacksonville and other metropolitan areas. And once we come up with winnable solutions that are working in other cities, that's when we bring those issues to our action, the Nehemiah Assembly, to press our leaders to adopt these winnable solutions that are working. And then we, of course, follow up. And so it's through that strategy that we have tackled things like civil citation issue, creating that user-friendly web-based website and issues of jaywalking, as well as working with restorative justice in our schools. And so that's our process. And we welcome anyone to come and join us to talk about issues that are of a concern mm-hmm. that we may be able to take on and present to the members of our community to address in the future.
Now, you're going to, in the issue of building trust, you're going to push the sheriff's office to set up a website where people could learn more about how cases are tracked, adjudicated. What would it look like? What type of information would be on it?
We have a pretty specific list of details, and the issues are basically, again, around where there have been complaints about encounters, where there may have been officer misconduct allegations, where those things are done. We need to know the outcome of those things. We need to know how they were processed, what was the finding. And so, again, we want to know how that works out in terms of, geography, where in the city maybe was this experience, in terms of demographics, who were the people involved, what was the age, race, socioeconomic, that kind of thing. So it's pretty detailed. And again, The importance of this is that most of the requests, if you make requests for public information, can take 6 months, mm-hmm. and you may not even find out what you really want to know. A website is the way anybody who can access, go to the public library even, and find out what's going on in our city.
And you've mentioned that other cities have done this. You have a model to follow.
Indianapolis is one that we found was very, very helpful. And Tan may know of some others that I'm not as much aware of, but that's one of the ones that we really looked at as
What's
being
a name
model.
Of the one in Indianapolis?
You know, I don't know what the title of the website is, to be honest with you. That hasn't been something that I've heard come up. I should have asked.
Yeah, we'll see if we can find it.
There you go.
Just kind of curious to take a look. Let's go to Stephen in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm so proud of not only ICARE, but of Sheriff Williams and State's Attorney Nelson for availing themselves to come in front of such a large gathering and to be challenged on issues. It's a brave, wonderful thing that goes on in that Nehemiah assembly. I'm so sorry the mayor has dropped out of that process, but other elected officials are so, they're willing to engage, and I think we'll have great progress, and I think that the website is a wonderful idea.
Thanks for that, Stephen. Yes, and you hold, Pastor Moss, you hold these officials' feet to the fire, but they keep coming back. They're coming back this year.
Absolutely. I think all public officials want to see their city be the best that it can be. And the process by which we research and find winnable solutions and present those winnable solutions help us to see what other cities are doing, other things that are working to solve problems of injustice and inequity in our city. And so we're very thankful for the cooperation of the sheriff as well as our state attorney and other public officials who have also worked on issues that we have presented over the years. With the school, we're now, we have 180 plus schools that are doing restorative justice where young people can solve their own problems, can learn how to resolve their conflicts, reduce school suspension. The bus hubs, which take people from areas of high unemployment to areas where there's job availability. We're just proud of the work that we've been doing and some of the successes that we had. So we thank God for our public officials.
Just a word about the process that we use. Sometimes folks come to our Nehemiah Assembly and may not know. We have a very tight agenda, and so it's not an open public forum. Our city officials know exactly what we're going to ask in advance. We've worked with them and prepped them knowing what they're going to be asked, mm-hmm. a yes or no question. And so sometimes that seems like we are being tough on them, but we believe that being tough for a few minutes on an issue that is important to thousands, if not, you know, tens of thousands of people is worth doing that for holding city officials accountable. And so we just want people to be clear that the Nehemiah Assembly has a very tight agenda. We work through it very carefully so we're in and out on time. And it can seem hard, but it's a process that gets results because it does hold them accountable to a yes or no answer.
It's the ICARE Nehemiah Assembly. It's coming up next Monday evening, April 23rd at 6:30 p.m. at the Abyssinia Missionary Baptist Church. They are up on the north side at 10325 Interstate Center Drive. Just go to icarejax.org for more information. And thanks so much to Pastor Bruce Havens of Arlington United Church of Christ, Pastor Tan Moss of Greater Grant Memorial AME Church, joining us this morning with some information about this important assembly. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead later. Lifting Up La Villa. We'll tell you about the La Villa Jazz and Heritage Fest. And we've got some live music on tap, so you want to keep listening for that. A little live jazz to start your morning off can't be bad. But up next, Understanding Addiction and the Brain. We'll speak with best-selling author Maya Salovitz. That's coming up as well. Right now, we need you to give us a call, too. Here's how.
Give us a call at 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at wjct.org. Good morning. I'm Kevin Merchart, producer of First Coast Connect here in our spring fund drive. We are almost at $10,000. That's not bad for a Tuesday, but we still need to raise about $65,000 to get our goal by the close of business on Friday. So make that call now. Do your bit. How about becoming a sustainer? $10 a month on your credit card or a bank draft. And it really adds up because you do your part and your neighbor does that. Guy down the street does this. And suddenly we are reaching our goal. But it's only made possible because listeners like you show your financial support. So make that call now. Thank you very much. 353-9528. 1-800-722-9528. Or go online at wjct.org. And don't forget, everybody who, and I mean everybody, who donates during this drive will be entered into a drawing to win a great package of stuff donated by local businesses on the First Coast. Its value is over $1,200, and it includes stuff from River City Brewing, Moss Fire Grill, The Bookmark, The Comedy Zone, Alhambra, Sweet Pete's, Diamond D Ranch, Adventure Landing. So we have a great package of stuff for you, just as a thank you for showing your financial support for this station. But you got to make that call first. That's 353-9528. 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org. Our TV station has been on for almost 60 years. September is the 60th anniversary of WJCT Public Television. We've been on the radio since 1972. That is 46 years. So it's been a long time. We've been bringing you great information and programming here for the First Coast. And now we have five TV stations. We have three radio stations, digital radio stations. Of course, we have a fantastic website where you can see on-demand videos and all sorts of information. You can get the news that if you missed, you can catch that. If you missed First Coast Connect, you can always go online and listen to the program. We have a podcast. We have all sorts of stuff out there for you to listen to. And it's all made possible because listeners like you show your financial support. So make that call right now. More than now, more than ever, we are here for you. You remember, we were here almost 24/7 during Hurricane Irma. The whole newsroom just sitting here, sleeping in our offices and coming on the air and giving you information. I remember getting lots of phone calls from people saying, thank you for being here. And they said it's because, well, the power was out. They had their little battery-operated radio, and we were the only ones they could get to know what was going on. We had all that serious flooding downtown. We had flooding in Riverside and so much. And we were able to bring you that information because listeners like you show your financial support. Because that's what we do. We are here to provide a service to you that you're not going to get anywhere else. So make that call right now, and thank you very much for your support. The number again is 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org. Every dollar truly makes a difference, and we thank you very much for your support for this, your public radio station.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9. Your community, your world, your music.
A high-profile speaker will appear next week in Jacksonville discussing a timely topic. As the opioid crisis grows in this city and nationwide, you won't want to miss the 2018 Exchange Club Family Center Child Abuse Prevention Conference. The keynote will be delivered by Maya Salovitz. She's an award-winning neuroscience author, journalist, and mental health advocate. She's also the author of the bestseller, The Unbroken Brain: A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction. Maya Salovitz is on the line now with more, and a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And if you have questions about The Unbroken Brain, this groundbreaking book from author and neuroscientist Maya Salovitz, give us a call at 549-2937. Now, what is so important about your book, Maya, is that it really breaks the dynamic, the traditional way that people have thought about drug abuse and addiction. We've typically defined it as a disease of the brain, or even the more outmoded idea that it was moral weakness. You really have a radical and a groundbreaking new way of looking at addiction, in essence, defining addiction as almost a learning disorder. Can you share a little bit about this theory of addiction with us?
Sure. So, I mean, one of the things that confounds everybody about addiction is that when you see people with addiction who are pursuing drugs, they look like they're sort of rationally making a conscious choice to put the drugs in front of their loved ones, in front of their job, ahead of anything else. And so that seems really immoral. And it also seems really chosen because it's like people plan deliberately in order to get their drugs. And so what I'm arguing is that addiction is a problem of the part of the brain that sets your priorities. And basically, that part of your brain is there to, you know, get you to survive and reproduce. And when it gets misguided towards a drug, that can be a real problem. So essentially what happens is you fall in love with a drug rather than a person, or rather than developing the attachment that you would develop when you have a new child. So you then pursue that as if your survival and your future depended on it. And, yeah, that looks very strange and very willful and very bad in many cases, but it's not that you are completely making a conscious choice. It's constrained by this priority-setting region.
And in your book, you share your personal story, right?
Yes.
Tell us that, too. And that really informs your understanding and your insights about this.
Sure, sure. So in my 20s, I was addicted to cocaine and heroin, and I experienced for myself how these priorities can go insanely wrong. I ended up having to drop out of Columbia and ended up shooting up 40 times a day. So,
wow.
And facing long prison term and all of this kind of thing for dealing. So it was really bad. And it was sheer luck that I managed to get into recovery when I did. It was about a year after I'd been arrested. So it wasn't like the arrest sort of forced me to hit bottom or wake up or any of that. That made me actually want to get high more because I needed, and now I had even more to try to escape from. And, you know, for me, I'd sort of been trying to escape all my life because I sort of have a weirdly oversensitive nervous system that means that, things that are, you know, don't bother anybody else can really destroy me sometimes. So anyway, once I'd found the drugs that seemed to fix that, I stuck with them, and that caused all of that problem. Mm. Eventually, though, I did realize that, and also from feeling so different so early in life, I also developed a sort of level of self-hatred that I sort of shudder to think back on these days. Anyway, so I eventually realized that the drugs were not working and this was not solving the problem I thought it was solving. It was making things worse. And I reached out to my parents and got into treatment and have been in recovery since then, which is now like 30 years.
30 years.
Yeah, which is like something I thought, it's funny because I said it as 20 years the other day, and I'm like, no, actually, that's wrong. I feel really old.
but you're still with us, and that's good and healthy.
Hey.
Now, here in this city, the local city council is looking at suing the manufacturers of opiates, Big Pharma. Other municipalities are looking at doing that. This city has also started a pilot program that's being informed and led in part by those who are experts in recovery treatment. They work at local recovery centers. But a pilot program is launching up in this city. It's a new way of approaching addiction and recovery and helping people, particularly those caught up in the opiate epidemic. This is something that has swept the country and caused enormous pain and costs. How can people that and community and civic leaders that are trying to grapple with this and treat people and figure out a way to respond to this crisis, how can the ideas in your book perhaps help them understand better what people in recovery need to get better?
Absolutely. So basically, addiction is defined by the National Institute on Drug Abuse and by the Diagnostic Manual of Psychiatry as compulsive drug use that continues despite negative consequences. Now, what do we try to use to stop addiction? Lots of punishment and lots of negative consequences, when, in fact, by definition, it is resistant to that. So we've got to stop all of that kind of stuff and start using things that work. Now, with opioids in particular, we have two treatments that cut the death rate by 50% or more. And these are long-term, possibly lifelong use of either methadone or buprenorphine, which is known as Suboxone. And that statement should not be controversial. Recovery houses should be dancing in the streets by the fact that we have something that cuts the death rate in half. Instead, we end up with people saying, oh, people aren't really in recovery. Medication shouldn't be used in addiction and all of these kinds of things that is really ending up killing people. So the best thing that communities can do is understand that people with addiction are human beings and that treating them with dignity and respect is going to be the best way to help, and that we have two medications that work really well that we need to reduce the barriers to so that people can get them. And one of the things I think people often don't understand about these medications is that there's two ways of using these medications. In one way, if you take the same dose at the same time every day and you're ready to do that, you will not be impaired, you will be able to drive, you will be able to care for your kids, you'll be just like anybody else. And so that's stabilization and it's as much recovery as anybody else. But also, for the people who continue to use, it reduces their chances of dying dramatically. So it's like sometimes you might see somebody on medication and they seem really messed up. That's generally because they're using other things on top, but they shouldn't be cut off from that medication because that will make them even more likely to die, and dead people are not going to recover.
Now, if we think about addiction through this framework you've defined as more of a developmental or learning disorder, are traditional approaches like 12-step programs, do you think, in this day and age, not as effective or not the way that we should be approaching helping people get treatment?
Well, I think the 12-step programs are an absolutely fabulous and wonderful supportive community for those who find it amenable. I think we made a real mistake when we decided to put it into formal treatment. I mean, AA's own eighth tradition says that people should not be paid for teaching or counseling the 12 steps, and virtually every rehab breaks that rule. What I think is that we should have evidence-based treatment that is not available for free in church basements, that does not violate people's First Amendment rights, as has been shown in several court cases when you're forced into it. So what we should have in treatment programs that taxpayers and insurers pay for is cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational enhancement therapy. All of these things work as well or better than 12-step with none of the problems. That said, people in recovery tend to require ongoing social support. And for those who find it attractive, 12-step programs can be a beautiful spiritual way of life that gives them that ongoing support that they need. So I am not, 12 steps, I mean, you're learning stuff as you do that. It's not like you're taking a medication or something like that. It's actually a learning process of dealing with various issues. I just think that, if we're going to actually treat addiction as a health problem, which I believe that it is, you can't have it be the only health problem where when you go into an official treatment center, you are told that the treatment is praying, confessing, and meeting. Because if you went into treatment for anything else, including depression or cancer or ADHD, and were told that, you would think you were not in mainstream treatment.
Okay. Now, in the first segment of this program this morning, we talked about local efforts in Jacksonville to reform issues with the criminal justice system. And one of those issues has to deal with, mandatory minimum sentences, for example, for drug offenses. You've talked publicly in the past that you believed that you were a young white woman who was going to an Ivy League school. You were privileged. that went a long way toward protecting you from being incarcerated for using hard drugs. You've called out the criminal justice system, too, in the way that it adjudicates drug-related cases, particularly for people of color.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that there is racial bias in the way we police and deal with drug problems. And it goes back to the roots of our drug laws, which were not passed by some group of scientists sitting down and saying, these ones are less dangerous, we should make them legal, and these ones are more dangerous, we should make them illegal, because you'd never be able to come up with our system by doing that. So it was racist in its origins, and it continues to be racist in its application. Again, I go back to, you know, the main definition we have for addiction is compulsive behavior that continues despite negative consequences. Prison is a negative consequence. This does not work. If it worked, if mandatory minimums worked, if sending people away for a zillion years solved addiction, we would have solved it by now. We wouldn't be in this crisis. You know, my home state, New York, we had 15 to life mandatory minimums for cocaine and heroin before we had a crack epidemic. If those things were so great, we should have never had a crack epidemic, and we should have no heroin in our town now. And let me tell you, we still have both of those drugs. So it's really, you know, everybody sort of complains about people with addiction, you know, doing the same thing and expecting different results and trying higher and higher doses, and it's still not working. Well, that's what our criminal justice system is doing. We keep trying the same things. Oh, let's give the death penalty to dealers. Oh, let's, you know, lock them up for even longer. Oh, let's be even crueler to people. Let's take away benefits. Let's do all this. All that ends up with is making people with addiction more miserable, more marginalized, more likely to want to get high. It traumatizes their children often, which means that you get another generation that is now primed to be at even higher risk of addiction. This does not work. Now, I'm not saying we want, like, you know, Philip Morris fentanyl. That would be terrible. Nobody wants that. But what we should do, absolutely, is stop wasting money arresting people for personal possession of drugs. Nobody can give me a coherent, good argument for doing that.
And are you still getting pushback from law enforcement and other groups when you talk about your approach to this?
I mean, it varies. I mean, obviously, there are still people who think that we need to be sending the right message, and that, like, the, you know, that if you decriminalize possession, everybody will run into the streets and start using. But, you know, we've had the experience of Portugal, where they decriminalized at least 10 years ago, and they have an extremely low overdose rate. They have fewer new heroin users. Their general drug use rate is no higher than the rest of Europe that didn't decriminalize. And so basically all of the sort of sky is falling kind of things that were predicted, if you did that, did not come to pass. So it's like we're literally wasting billions of dollars cycling these same people. You know, if you listen to the stories of people with addiction who are on the street, they've been arrested 20, 30, 40, 50 times. They're still out there.
They're still out there, yeah.
It's not working.
Yeah. It's not, yeah. So, yeah, what the old saying, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So your approach is a new way of looking at this. So, Maya Salovitz, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for giving us a few minutes.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Maya Salovitz, author of The Unbroken Brain, one of the highlights of the upcoming Exchange Club Family Center Child Abuse Prevention Conference coming up April 26th on the UNF campus. Go to exchangeclubfamilycenter.com for more information. In a moment, live jazz right here in studio. The La Villa Jazz and Heritage Fest is coming up too. We'll tell you about it in just a few minutes. Keep listening.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the Compassionate Guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours. Available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
It's been a year since Sesame Street introduced Julia, a Muppet on the autism spectrum. She's a shy 4-year-old who likes to paint and pick flowers. Julia is just one way that Sesame Street is helping little kids identify with grown-up issues. What impact are she and the show's other new characters having on kids and their parents? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, my interview with former FBI Director James Comey, which I just recorded. I asked about how he seems to be sounding an alarm about the president. We talked about the accusations Comey used a double standard in making public the Hillary Clinton emails, but not discussing Russian interference in the election. We talked about lots more. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
More than 6 months after Hurricane Irma, visitors are returning to the Florida Keys, but local residents, yeah, they're still struggling.
I think people are tired of hearing how the Keys have recovered and everything's going great, and it's not for a lot of us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, living with Irma's aftermath. Next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it was a show-stopping performance over the weekend at the Coachella Music and Arts Festival out west as Beyoncé took the stage, the first African-American woman to headline the festival. One of the songs she chose to perform in her set has special meaning. It's Lift Every Voice and Sing, also known sometimes as the Black National Anthem. African Americans everywhere hold the song dear. It was written by Jacksonville teacher and author James Weldon Johnson in 1899 to be sung publicly here in this city at a celebration of Abraham Lincoln's birthday. The song had tragic significance because it was a call to action for African Americans at the time fighting to survive and thrive as lynchings were taking hold in the Jim Crow South. Now, against this historic backdrop, today the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville and the Durkeyville Historical Society are teaming up to bring a free jazz fest to the La Villa district that was once home to James Weldon Johnson. And the goal is to create a sense of place for the new Lift Every Voice and Sing Park. How about that? Tony Allegretti heads up the Cultural Council, and also here Lloyd Washington from the Durkeyville Historical Society. Hey, guys.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Thanks so much for being with us. And this is so exciting. Lloyd, let's start with you to actually create a park for this incredible song penned by Jacksonville's own James Weldon Johnson. And Beyoncé now has brought this song to a whole new generation of fans.
Well, I'm really proud to hear that she did the song the other day. It has quite a history, and it brings emotion and passion to a lot of people when they find out that, yes, they were born here in Jacksonville. And the song was actually written here in Jacksonville.
Yep, and performed for the first time here
in Jacksonville.
And so, Tony Allegretti, tell us about the festival and how it's going to fund something really cool for the La Villa District.
Sure. Well, the idea of the festival really, first and foremost, is to that sense of place. It's on the birth site of James Weldon Johnson and John Rosamond Johnson. They are heroes. They are really unrivaled in terms of accomplishments for Jacksonville folks. And so this is a free jazz fest to come out and visit their birthplace and listen to jazz. And we've got musicians coming in from all over the country. The back line is a John Lumpkin back line. And we've got a big band with Micah Bate, John Irbagon from New York. Jameson Ross is from here. He's coming home from New Orleans. We've got Sharonie Wade and Yasushi Nakamura. And so they're all coming to flocking to Jacksonville to do this free jazz fest. So it's a legit straight ahead jazz fest. We're really excited to do it.
And this is so exciting because it will happen at the corner of Lee and Adams Street, Lloyd, which is the future site of the Lift Every Voice and Sing Park, the birthplace of James Weldon Johnson and his brother, John Rosamond Johnson.
Yes, we are planning on putting a memorial there for the two. We're also planning on putting a statue there. And hopefully this will bring enough synergy and bring people to Jacksonville to see it.
To see it, sure. And so come on out Sunday, April 22nd from noon to 7 to the corner of Lee and Adams Street for this free festival, live jazz, music, fun, food. Go to culturalcouncil.org/LaVilla for more. And right now we have a special treat, Tony Allegretti, some live jazz. Tell us about the
so
band.
Yeah, so this is a trio. It's John Lumpkin on percussion. John brought DeAndre Letsum on sax and John Baptiste on upright bass. Hope we see everyone on Sunday. It's bring your own chair. No coolers because we're selling drinks to raise money for the park. So go ahead, Tony.
All right, let's hear it, guys. Take it away.
All right, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1.
Allegretti, Lloyd Washington, and band. Thanks, guys. Come on out Sunday to the Jazz and Heritage Festival in the LaVilla neighborhood. It's free at the corner of Lee and Adams Street downtown. Thanks for the music, guys.
Thank you for having us, Melissa. Thank you for having us.
And we'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.